Tonight we will be resuming our study of sermons from the Old Testament, and we'll be looking at the first of the minor prophets, Hosea. Before we do so, I want to take about 8-10 minutes, if I could, and give you a quick summary of what our teams did in Kayenta. So this will not be a full mission night report, but I just want to kind of highlight what the team did while they were there. We had two crews that went to Kayenta in April. One went during spring break, and another team went 2 weeks later. While we were in Kayenta, we saw all kinds of extremes. I think one day we counted 10 different types of weather that we saw, everything from snow to brilliant sunshine to you name it, we saw it. We saw some incredibly beautiful scenery while we were there. You can see all across the state of Arizona. It's a unique state in that you see a broad range of types of landscape, and it changes very quickly. About every 20, 30 miles, you'll see something different. The Navajo people are different from some other nations of the Indian nations in that they were not moved to this area because of the movement of the white man, if you will, into the country and moving them out of their natural landscape. The Navajo moved to the Arizona region and Utah in this area where the reservation now is about 500 years ago. And though there may have been some confines placed on it, this is generally speaking where they chose to live when they first came there. And we know that at least in the last 100 years or so, they became sheep herders. And so you will see sheep quite a lot around the landscape. We saw them quite often as we traveled. And a lot of what they eat, if they eat meat, it comes from sheep. The most beautiful things we saw there were the people. Special folks. It's not a huge congregation. The congregation in Kayenta. Kayenta is in the kind of the northeast corner of Arizona, not far from the Utah border. It's about 2 hours northeast from the Grand Canyon, if that helps any to get you in perspective. For us, it was about a 5.5 hour drive from Phoenix Airport to Kayenta. They run about 25 to 30 on a Sunday morning, and we'll go a lot into that. You've heard other reports, and hopefully Josh is going to be able to come later in the year and visit with us. But as you look at this picture of some of the brethren with some of our folks, I want you to notice in the picture that on the left-hand side there are two men, and then there's another one on the far right-hand side, kind of mixed in with several ladies. This is by no means the entire congregation. What is extremely unique about the Kayenta congregation is that they have a number of Navajo Christian men. There are 10 to 12 Navajo Christian men, best I understand, and we'll get an updated report when Josh, if Josh is able to come. My understanding is there's 10 to 12 Christian Navajo men in the entire nation. 4 to 5 of those are in this congregation. He has been more successful in reaching Navajo men than any preacher in the entire Navajo nation. There are more Christian men in this congregation than in any other congregation in that particular nation. So I just wanted to mention that. I think that is significant. What is also significant is the number of children. You know, if they've got 30 that attend on a Sunday morning, half of those are going to be children. And so they have a very, very bright future for the congregation. Now the danger for them is keeping those kids when they become teenagers. That is a real dilemma they fight. That's why our young people going, and our young people have gone on mission trips there 2 years, that's why that's such a big deal. Because they need to see, these young children need to see teenagers who keep their faith, because so few teenagers there keep theirs. And so it's very, very important that we continue to encourage them in that direction. We were able to worship with the brethren, both teams, on a Sunday. Also, we were able to spend time with them throughout the week. This is Josh who preaches there, and y'all may remember that he came to visit with us last year. Also, while we're there, John Z. Lewis did a painting class for the ladies, and they had a wonderful time spending time together. Even some of the men decided they wanted to try it as well, so when the ladies finished up, she had to get the stuff back out, I think, for Terry in particular, and she even framed their pictures for them, and they just had a great and wonderful fellowship. I know on the trip we went that Cherry did a children's class on that Sunday night while the adults were in a class in the main auditorium. They cooked for us each evening, and we enjoyed spending time together, and they trained Cherry and I think maybe some of the others in how to do fry bread. She's pretty good at it. She made some at our last get-together. Also, some of the brethren would come up and help us work in the day. In this picture on the far right-hand side, you have Terry Lawrence, who I had the privilege to stay with while I was there. I think a lot more came to work during the first group's trip than the second group. they didn't come as much during our trip to work during the day because they'd used all their off time with the first trip. They had said they had to make money the second time so they could pay their bills and feed their families. But they came up and worked with us. Terry, incidentally, is planning this fall to enroll, or actually I guess is enrolled, but is planning if he can raise his money to start at Bear Valley Bible Institute in Denver, Colorado. That is significant in that he'll be only the second native Navajo preacher in the nation. There's only one preacher in the Navajo Nation who is actually Navajo. And so Terry seeks to be the second, and he's in the process of raising that money. And so if you know some folks who might help with that, I know that would be greatly appreciated. We had a devotional each night. Of course, our teams did every morning, but we gathered with them each night. And so basically, we had two gatherings on Sunday, and then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we got together and ate and had a devotional together every evening. So we spent some real quality time together. Even though the purpose of this trip was to build, we had a lot of spiritual fellowship as well. They worship in this metal building, and you've heard Josh talk about it. Basically, the right end of this building consists of kind of an open foyer area, some restrooms, a couple of classrooms, and a small little kitchen area and a storage room. The left side is just an open auditorium. And what they wanted for our teams, and this is the first team that went in, what they wanted us to do is they had the finances to buy materials, but they didn't have the money and know-how to be able to do the building themselves or to be able to afford to hire people. You have to remember in Kayenta, you've got the local population, but if you want anything, you've got to drive about 2.5 hours anywhere to get anything. So getting materials, hiring outside labor is a pretty expensive process and a pretty difficult process. And so basically what they had is their auditorium was just a shell. You can kind of see a look at it here, and the first team is they're coming in and just trying to look the place over. And what they wanted is they wanted in the front of the auditorium, which is this view right here, in the front of the auditorium, they wanted a kind of a pulpit area, kind of like we have here. They wanted a baptistry installed, and so they purchased a baptistry and need somebody to put it in and plumb it in and all that stuff. They wanted on the right side a library slash changing area. On the left side, they wanted a classroom and study slash changing area. All that needed to be put in, plus some things needed to finish in the auditorium. They needed the ceiling hung. They just had a lot of work that needed to be done on their building, and they just didn't have the means to do it. And so I guess it was last November, Josh and I started talking about this intently when he was here for the Columbia Bible Institute. And so that's how these trips came together. So I want to simply say that basically the goal of the first team, and Hollis and Virgil led this first team, their job was to go in and start framing things out. They started framing in the front of the building, putting in these rooms. They first of all had to just start with the bare studs, and then as they worked their way along, they began to add the sheetrock to it, and you just gradually see it taking form. You see here they're doing the floor of what would be the pulpit area. Hollis is trying to decide what they're going to do with the ceiling because they had to work around the ducts and the direction that the vents were facing. And so they had to work as best they could with the existing structure. You can see the baptistry there waiting to be put in place. And so they're going through this process of bit by bit building this building, and everybody had work to do, and I think Sharon became the master saw person during the week, and I think in a few minutes you may see a picture of her being officially given her pencil by Virgil. You've graduated from saw school when you get your own pencil. That means nobody else marks it for you. You mark your own stuff, cut your own stuff. You are now the boss. And so she was able to get hers before the week was over. But you can see what's happening is the frame is finally gradually being filled in. The sheetrock is being put up. There she is getting her pencil. It was a special moment. And just wanted to show you some pictures of this process of going from a bare room to a place that is looking more and more like maybe what we see in this auditorium with walls kind of similar to this, kind of angled in, and a pulpit area and a baptismal area, and the rooms on either side. I think Doug Williams won the prize for the most injuries during the week. He was bleeding from most parts of his body by the time that he came home, and he won the award for that. You can see a bandaged thumb and a bandaged arm there. Truly, he gave his blood for the Lord. You can see there, they're putting in the baptistry in place, and then they're putting the wall board in front of it, and it's a little bit different color because it has to be a waterproof sheetrock. And so just kind of wanted you to get some pictures of how it's gradually taking shape. And that by the time our crew got there, and this is our crew gathering one morning for a devotional, then the rooms had all been put in, much of the sheetrock on the rooms, all the front sheetrock had been put in, but then also the sheetrock needed to be finished up a little bit inside the rooms, mudding, taping, all those kinds of, a lot of other things needed to be done. We did a little work in the restrooms. We were not able to completely finish that. We were able to put some of the backing up that they wanted on the walls and put up some of the privacy walls in that bathroom. We also made some progress on the sink. You can't see it in this picture, but Virgil was able to cut out and put the sinks in and begin the plumbing process while we were there. We weren't able to do much with our kitchen because they didn't have the supplies. They weren't able to get the supplies we needed there. One of the problems there is just getting supplies and tools and all that. And we took a lot of stuff with us. One thing Virgil was able to do is he was able to plumb in the sink, which is a pretty big deal. You think about how hard it might be to have a get-together without a sink at all. You know, every time that you had a church potluck, there was no place to get water. And so that made it pretty difficult for him, and so he was able to solve that problem. One of the big things our crew did, and we had a crew of three guys, Jim, Charles, and Ken, their job was to try to put in the ceiling. And so they hung the drop ceiling and put in those lights you see. It was amazing the difference once those lights had been put up. In fact, those of us doing sheetrock suddenly found all the mistakes we'd made when they turned the lights on, and we could see for the first time after about 3 days of sheetrocking and mudding in the dark. But it was amazing how much it lit up the room. And what you begin to see as I just kind of work through these pictures is the walls, by the time we left, the walls had all been mudded and taped. They'd all been sanded. They had been primered. They had, in fact, so before the primer, they have a texturing that they put on their wall, and you got a big 60, 70-pound thing you have to hold up and spray the texturing on the wall and smooth it down. And then once it dries, you come back and put your primer on. So been through that process. They'd hung the ceiling, they'd hung the lights, we had put up, Virgil and John's and their crew took care of things like trimming in all the doors, hanging doors. They also did work on cabinets for the library. We weren't able to put the doors on because they had a different hinge than we needed for that, but they were able to get the bookshelves built for the library. We're able to do the plumbing. You can kind of see it running along the back wall. That's going to allow them to run the baptistry, and the baptistry was up and functioning by the time our teams left. They wanted windows looking from the auditorium into those two rooms, and Virgil got those put in place and framed in, and the rooms framed in. You can kind of see in their pile of stuff back in the back corner where they put a little storage place up under the steps and framed it in. It's back in the back there by the ladders and the yellow level that's sticking up in the air. I just kind of want to give you a sense of how much changed in the process of two different teams going in for 2 weeks at a time, such that when we left, they were going to come back and put on a coat of paint, they would pop the ceiling tiles in, and it would look like a finished auditorium. And they could immediately start using that auditorium. Of course, they've already been using it, and also use the classrooms that were attached to it. So basically what I want to do is just kind of show you that and let you see the impact that our folks had on that congregation. They are very, very excited. In fact, I just got Friday, I believe it was, a letter signed by a number of members of the congregation thanking us and this congregation, what you've been doing for a long time, but also thanking for our team for coming in to work there. And so I just wanted to briefly mention that to you just as another example of where members at Graymere are making a difference. Would you open your Bibles to the book of Hosea? As you turn to Hosea, I believe it was at 9:30 p.m. on October the 3rd, 1960, that you had the first Andy Griffith episode, and it was in syndication, I guess, for... It came on live, I guess, 249 times before, I guess, it went into syndication is probably a better way to put it. And it has been on nonstop just about any day. You can find somewhere on your cable channels the Andy Griffith Show. And you know, most of us remember that one of the key characters in the Andy Griffith Show was the character Gomer. We're going to talk about Gomer tonight, but we're not going to talk about that Gomer. We're going to talk about the Gomer in the Bible. The last time we were able to do our Sermons From series, we were looking at the book of Daniel. We're now ready to move to the Minor Prophets. And really, Minor Prophet is an unfortunate name for these last 12 books of the Old Testament. Sometimes these last 12 books were called the Book of the 12, because often they were all on one scroll together. And they're called Minor Prophets not because they were minor in significance. They're called Minor Prophets because their writings are shorter. Okay, the longer books were called major, and the shorter books were called minor. And so as we spend some time over the next few weeks looking at the Minor Prophets, a different one each week, I just want us to understand that they're all major, they're all significant, they all are important. And Hosea is one of the more interesting stories in the Old Testament among the prophets. And we're reminded in his story that the life of a prophet was often a very, very difficult life. Let's talk just a little bit as far as setting for the book of Hosea, first of all. When we think about setting, Hosea was called to ministry. First of all, he was a citizen of the northern kingdom. He makes reference to our king in chapter 7. I want to say around verse 5, may not have the verse exactly right. You can check me on that, where he's referring to the northern king of Israel. Remember that Israel was divided into two kingdoms, the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel. And so he is a citizen of the northern kingdom. And he prophesied roughly from about 755 down to about 710 B.C. So he started roughly 755 years before Christ. He began his prophetic work during the reign of Jeroboam II of the northern kingdom. And Jeroboam I is kind of the evil, wicked king that all the evil, wicked kings in the Old Testament are compared to. So anytime a guy chooses or his family chooses as a name for their son or a king chooses as a throne name, the name of a previous wicked king, it gives you a pretty good idea of the direction they're going to go into. The last six kings of Israel, four of them were assassinated. So it was a pretty tumultuous time, but it was also a prosperous time. It was a pretty dangerous time to be king, but the kingdom as a whole did pretty well during this time. Now, Hosea's name is actually Hoshea. It means salvation. That is the same name as the last king of Israel. The reason most of our English Bibles call him Hosea instead of Hoshea is so that we don't confuse the prophet with the king. But if you were reading their family records, they'd both spell their names the exact same way. So, Hosea prophesies at a time that covers over into the end and the demise of the northern kingdom. Remember, in 722 B.C., the northern kingdom of Israel is destroyed by the Assyrians. Let's just briefly hit the highlights of the story. If you look at the book of Hosea, really the first three chapters deals with the training of Hosea, and then chapter 4 through 14 is the teaching of Hosea. In other words, God is training him, using him as an illustration in 1 through 3. And then 4 through 14, you have his actual teaching, his actual prophetic work. Now, all we're going to try to do for just in the few moments we have tonight is just hit the highlights of what is found in those first three chapters. And my guess is that you've, at some point in your life, maybe heard a little bit about the story of Hosea and his wife, Gomer. We're going to call her Gomer. There's two reasons for that. One is so that we don't confuse her with the guy we know from the Andy Griffith Show. The other reason we're going to do that is because that was probably how she pronounced her name. Gomer is probably what she was known by. But basically, as we look in chapter 1, what God does is He goes to Hosea and says, "I need you to marry a prostitute." I was reminded this morning of how many folks who have got anniversaries. You know, the Yates just had an anniversary, their 50th anniversary. And I think we announced this morning three different couples who've got anniversaries that are 50 or 60 plus that are happening this week. I think my parents have been married 43 years. And as you think about how long you've been married, or maybe loved ones you know have been married, it's not easy to be married. Okay, and sometimes there are struggles along the way and there are problems. And I think if you talk to any of these couples who've had a 50th, a 60th, a 63rd, 65th, whatever it may be, they're going to say there were some struggles and some tough times along the way. But even though I think every marriage has its struggles, my guess is there aren't too many marriages around us that are quite like the marriage between Hosea and Gomer. What God does is He begins, and we're reminded that it was often tough to be a prophet. For example, it's interesting, when you deal with Jeremiah, you look in Jeremiah 16, God told Jeremiah he couldn't marry at all. He then goes to Hosea and says to Hosea, "You can marry, but I need you to go and marry a prostitute." Now, under the law, a priest was forbidden to marry a prostitute, and it was frowned upon in general when anyone did. Yet here God orders him to go and marry a prostitute. Not only does He tell him to do that, but they end up getting married. They have children. And you can find the names of their children are found in chapter 1. They have a son that he names Jezreel. He then has a daughter that he names Lo Ruhamah, and then has a son, a third child, that he names Lo Ami. Okay, so God commands him to marry a prostitute. He then has three children, two boys and a girl, who are given very specific names with very specific meanings. Then we find in chapter 3, apparently his wife leaves him and goes back to a life of prostitution. She has now not only gone back to a life of prostitution, she's living with somebody else, and it seems that she has become a slave. And so in chapter 3 of Hosea, he actually has to go and buy her back, it says, for 15 shekels and some barley. If we go back to the book of Exodus, we'll find that that was the common price for a slave in that particular time. So that's the gist of the story in those first two chapters, sometimes called the training of Hosea, but really what's happening here is God is using Hosea and his family as an object lesson for all of Israel. So let's talk just a little bit about the significance of that very simple story. We talked about in our Wednesday night class that we've had upstairs, the College and Young Professionals group, those in college and just out of college. We talked a little bit about the difficulties of helping people learn and remember things in a society that doesn't have a lot of the things we have. In their world, they didn't have radio, TV, internet. You couldn't even take notes. Okay, if you wanted to write something down, you had to have a broken piece of pottery, or you had to carve it on some animal skin or in some clay and then go bake it in the oven. I mean, it was just a big deal to write something down. So most people didn't write a lot. Most things were passed on through some other means, through stories. We talked about in that class that one of the things God does to help people remember things in that kind of an environment is that He uses visuals all the time. The feasts involved visuals. The sacrifices were, in essence, visuals. And He just has a lot of things designed to help people remember things. And so sometimes He uses a prophet and his life as a visual or as visuals for a message He wants to teach. Now, that's not an easy thing for a prophet to do, but if his life is focused on doing what is best for God, in other words, if he puts the cause, if he puts the Father above himself, then he's willing to do that. And so, Hosea was willing to do that. There is a message sent through each of the individuals that are involved in the story of Hosea and his family. First of all, there is Gomer. And she was a symbol of the unfaithfulness of Israel. If you look in chapter 2, he talks about in verse 2, "Contend with your mother, contend, for she is not my wife, I am not her husband, and let her put away her harlotry from her face, and her adultery from between her breasts." He goes on in verse 5, "For your mother has played the harlot, she has conceived them, she who conceived them has acted shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink." He says in verse 7, "She will pursue lovers, but she will not overtake them. She will seek them, but will not find them. She will say, I will go back to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now." She does not know that it was I who gave her grain, the new wine and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold when they used it for Baal. Therefore I will take back my grain at harvest time and my new wine in its season. Gomer became symbolic of the sinfulness of Israel. Israel had literally, all through the Old Testament, Israel is described as the bride of God. His people, His bride. And Israel is pictured often in the Old Testament as being an unfaithful spouse. So, symbolized in having a wife who had lived in prostitution, you have basically a nation that is living in spiritual prostitution. They are committing adultery with false gods. When you look at, in fact, the word covenant basically is just a marriage. And remember we talked about in Exodus chapter 20 that the Ten Commandments are like the vows spoken at a marriage and wedding ceremony. And what God is saying is you've broken your vows. Just as Gomer not only had come out of a background of prostitution, she went back to it. She was living with another man. She was living in slavery. She left her children. She left her husband. And God says, Israel, that's exactly what you've done to me. Now, in particular, they were worshiping and committing spiritual adultery with the false god Baal. And Baal is the god of rain, who is said to provide rain, and the god of fertility, at least in the pagan cults. He was not a true god, a false god, but that's what they said he did. And so what Jesus says, or God says, is specifically, you didn't realize it was, I was the one who provided rain for your crops. I was the one who made your wheat grow. I was the one who gave you oil and all those things. And even though I gave them to you, you took them and gave them to somebody else. In other words, it's kind of like when they got married and God gave gifts to the bride. Then the bride took the gifts and gave them to her lover that she had committed adultery with. She took the gifts given to her by her husband and gave them to a man she was being unfaithful with. God says that's what Israel was doing to him. The children are symbolic as well. Not only is Gomer symbolic of Israel's unfaithfulness, the children were symbolic of God's judgment. Jezreel is named after the valley where Ahab had killed Naboth in his vineyard. You can go back to 1 Kings chapter 19. It's also the valley where Jehu had ended the house of Ahab with a great slaughter in 2 Kings chapter 9. Now, Jeroboam II is of the house of Jehu. And because Jehu had gone too far, and because of the sinfulness of the house of Jeroboam, when he says that the firstborn child is to be called Jezreel, it's a reminder that God's judgment is coming upon this household, just as at the same place it had come upon the household of Ahab. Lo Ruhamah is a word that means either one of two things, no mercy. The word lo in Hebrew means no or not. So it means no mercy or one who has not been loved by a father. But it's a withdrawing of love and mercy. And that's what Israel was going to be facing because they were rejecting their God who loves them. The final son, or the daughter was named Lo Ruhamah, but the final son is named Lo Ami. Ami, I is the possessive pronoun on the end, which means my. Ami means my people. And so Lo Ami means not my people. The message is you were my people, but you've rejected that relationship and you rejected me as your God. You rejected me as your husband. And so you are no longer my people. And so those are all a message of judgment. But then there is Hosea. And Hosea is symbolic of the love and graciousness of God. That even though they deserved God's justice and they would face punishment, God was not totally rejecting them. God would take them back. And that they needed to return to their husband. And all the punishment that they were going to face was not designed to push them away permanently, but was designed to help them to realize all God had done for them and to turn them back to God. It's interesting to me that if we look in the pages of the New Testament, that the church is described as the bride of Christ. Remember, you can look in places like Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 and following. There it talks about the fact the relationship between the husband and the wife is like the relationship between Christ and the church. It talks about how Christ wants to present us as spotless and unblemished before Himself and before the Father. I think as we think about Hosea's story, we need to think about the fact that when we became Christians, we put on Christ. We were literally clothed in Christ, like a person putting on a wedding garment, according to Galatians chapter 3 and verse 27. We became a part of the church, the body of Christ, the bride of Christ. In other words, we made a commitment to Jesus. We made a commitment to God. We made a covenant with God, just like a person makes a marriage covenant. And we took on His name. From the day we were baptized into Christ, we were known as Christians. Now, the question we need to ask ourselves is, are we like Israel? Are we like Gomer? So many Christians have sold out to the world. So many Christians have adulterated themselves to the power and possessions and privilege that the world offers. I can't tell you the times that I've had somebody come in my office and their marriage is in trouble and they'll talk to me about a spouse who they'll say, you know, they kind of come and go as they please. They'll be here a few nights, and then I won't see them for a week. And then I'll hear they've stayed with this person, and they've slept with that person. And then they'll come roaming back through, and they'll be there for a few more days, and then they'll leave again. And how many times are we like that in our relationship with God? We show up on Sunday morning and we're there and we worship Him and we praise Him and act like we love Him and are married to Him. But then He doesn't see us Monday to Saturday because we're out there in the world doing things that show unfaithfulness to Him. So many times His church sails out to the world and we conform and we go along to get along. Really, this is a lesson for Israel about faithfulness and about the love of God. And so the question for us tonight is, are we faithful? And have we rejected or do we live in the love of God? Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? On his 50th wedding anniversary, the automaker Henry Ford was asked, what's the key to having a blissful marriage? He said, it's just like the auto industry. You stick to one model. I think that applies in marriages, and I think that applies to our relationship with God. And the question that each of us need to ask ourselves honestly, we need to ask, am I sleeping around on God? Am I acting like I love Him on Monday, and then acting like on Sunday, and then on Monday I love my job, and on Tuesday I love my recreation, and on Wednesday I love my money, and then Sunday I get back to God again? Or when God looks at my life, does He know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I am faithful to Him every moment of every day? If you're here tonight, maybe if you're like me, you realize that there are times in our lives when we mess up, we make mistakes, that all of us at one time or another have let God down and have disappointed Him. The story of Hosea says that no matter what we've done, no matter how far into slavery and adultery we are, if we'll come back home, He loves us and will take us back. I'm reminded of Romans chapter 5 and verse 8. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Hosea went and got Gomer from the slave trader's stand and bought her back. Jesus Christ went to the cross of Calvary and bought us back. If that love doesn't transform our hearts and our lives, then I don't know what can. It's that love we offer tonight as we stand and as we sing.